We will continue our steps towards observations of stellar systems. And in order to do so, we have to realize that all observations are averages. Averages over time, averages over space, and in particular, if we look at stellar systems, averages over velocity space. Now, even though we may think we possess all the equations we need in order to properly model a stellar system, and I think that at least for a Newtonian system we do, this averaging is bound to be a problem. Even if we were to write down the exact solution of the Boltzmann equation that we discussed previously, that wouldn't really help us very much because the components in that equation are not direct observables. Very, very rare exceptions excluded. To give you but one example, the Gaia satellite that will monitor the positions and the velocities of, let us say, a million stars or so in the solar neighborhood is an exception, because in that respect we can at least hope to get a reasonable snapshot of 6+1 dimensional phase space, which is indeed what this thing was designed to do. That is, however, the exception. If we want to study external stellar systems, that is, external further away than a few kiloparsec or thereabouts, we are of necessity taking averages, and in some cases, gross averages. The one thing that we do not take an average of is not necessarily an advantage. We do not necessarily take an average over time. We take a snapshot of such systems. And that, rather than being a help, is in this case a hindrance, because if we could only observe a stellar system evolving over a reasonable fraction of time, we would know very, very much more than we actually do. There again, there are exceptions. For instance, some of the more nearby open star clusters we can, in fact, follow in the course of time, just simply by taking observations with a time base of approximately a few years or thereabouts. Another case in point that I think you should be very interested in is the galactic center, where, due to the presence of a supermassive black hole, the stellar velocities are so very much bigger than they are in the solar neighborhood that, in fact, it has turned out to be possible to follow the individual trajectories of some of the stars, in fact, a few dozen of the stars, in the galactic center, and thereby obtain a reasonable estimate of what that actual dynamics is like. These remain exceptions, however. Now, if we were to take averages, you might say that that is not necessarily much of a problem. After all, I hope that we're all familiar in our everyday world with the phenomena of gas dynamics and fluid dynamics. Every time you take a swim, you take an average over an untold number of water molecules in your swimming pool. And still, you are more or less familiar with its effects. And similarly, if you see the clouds move in the atmosphere, if you feel the wind blow, then at least you have a reasonable idea of what this is all about, even though there again you're taking averages over an untold number of particles. Indeed, there is an analogy between gas dynamics and fluid dynamics and stellar dynamics, which I will expand on during today's lectures. However, I wish to point out to you that in the case of taking averages, there is a drastic difference between the two, and that is part of the reason why it is intuitively so very unobvious what stellar systems do. I have already presented one example to you during these lectures, namely a stellar disk, half of the stars of which was rotating one way and the other half of the stars rotating the other way. Just try to do that in the swimming pool with your water molecules, and you simply not succeed because your subgrid model is so very different in both cases, and because, on the other hand, also the left-hand side, where we used to put a zero on the Boltzmann equation in equilibrium, is so very different in both cases. And all those things we will have to consider separately. In particular, the subgrid model of a many-body system is a parting of ways between, on the one hand, the streaming behavior that we see in the case of gas dynamics and hydrodynamics, and the particle behavior we see in the case of stellar dynamics. There again, you can sort of intuit what the difference is going to be. Consider, for instance, not just simply a flowing gas, such as the air in the atmosphere, but a reactive gas, such as the mixture of shall we say, air and diesel oil in your engine. In that case, chemical reactions dominate the subgrid model. And as you know from basic thermodynamics, statistics of many body systems is to a very large extent a matter of equitably distributing energy amongst the particles. Therefore, if your system has a very large number of internal degrees of freedom, then you have a different situation than if they do not. For instance, there is a difference in the way in which a monatomic gas behaves and the way in which a gas behaves that is made up of molecules, because molecules have a large number of internal degrees of freedom, each of which can in principle absorb a certain amount of energy and thereby contribute to the state of motion of the overall system. Similarly, if you have a reactive mixture, then the combination of two particles might generate energy and thereby also influence the way in which the system behaves. In the initial lectures, I had already warned you that such a condition does in fact exist in the case of stellar systems. To it, if you have a binary star and you have a third star interacting with that binary, then that in a sense is reminiscent of, in a sense similar of, what you get in a reactive gas mixture. Because then, of course, the orbital energy, the binding energy of the binary star, and the orbital energy of the intruding third star, as long as the sum is constant, can interchange. They can trade off against one another and thereby influence in the long term, in the long run, the overall system of the stars. Now then, coming back to the original point, when we try to compare our theoretical models to actual observations, we do need to take averages. And in order to do so, we can, of course, use our basic Boltzmann equation that we have developed previously. And that is indeed what today we are going to do. We're going to use this Boltzmann equation, the equation for the distribution function, as effectively a dynamical equation in statistics. It tells us how the probability that you find number of particles with a certain position at a certain velocity at a certain time, that obeys, in the collisionless case, you put a zero here, the Boltzmann equation where you have df by dt plus v df by dx plus a times df by dv. Now, I had hitherto suppressed the vector indices. All right, just simply written as if position and velocity were scalars in order to simplify the equation. But as we're going to see today, this cannot really be maintained and in fact is the cause of a lot of problems that we have when solving these equations. Using the Einstein summation convention, I can easily turn this into a vector equation just simply by writing it like this, so that here you have effectively the inner product of the velocity and the spatial gradient of the distribution function, and here you have the inner product of the acceleration and the velocity gradient of the distribution function. Already such a small change shows you that we're in for an enormous amount of trouble once we start taking averages. If simply we want to take the average over this equation, life is not really so super hard, because all we need to do in that case is just simply take this whole schmear and integrate it over velocity space. However, you can already see that this is likely to lead to problems, because even this term is straightforward, right? The average over df by dt. So let us see what comes out of this. Your df by dt term put in here is just simply the partial derivative, because the bounds here are not time dependent, is a time derivative of the integral of f over all velocity space. And that is just simply the total number of particles at a given position. So you think, okay, cool. Here we just simply by averaging have already taken care of the first term here. That is just simply the time rate of change of the particle density. Fine. It is here, by the way, that we also see what difference it makes that we have a partial differential equation rather than a substantial differential equation. You will recall that all this originally derived from a d by dt, a substantial time derivative expression, and now we have a partial time derivative. As you recall from classical mechanics, all equations of motion that use substantial time derivatives effectively follow a particle in their trajectory. Follow the moon around the Earth, and the Earth around the sun, and the sun around the galaxy, blah, 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 blah. A partial derivative, however, takes a fixed position in space and time and looks at the derivatives at that particular location. So rather than following a particle in its trajectory, you take a fixed box, in this case in space, in velocity, and in time, so in seven-dimensional space, and you just simply watch what comes in and what goes out. And just, you keep this fixed, right? That is why, typically, all equations deriving from this Boltzmann equation and also from the non-collisionless Boltzmann equation are referred to as streaming equations, where you have a basic stream going through a fixed position along a fixed observing station, as it were, in six dimensions. That's why I say 6 plus 1, right? But basically, you are correct, yes. What I'm drawing here is a fixed box in position space. You add a dimension in velocity space. You could, in principle, if you wanted to, also add the time dimension in this, so that your entire system is represented by a single value, a single location, right? Perhaps I should not have mixed my explanations, because this approach, where your entire system is represented by one particle, is popular in certain theories of statistical mechanics, but it is not typically used in stellar dynamics. So perhaps I should withdraw that remark, yes. However, if then we take the second term, we need to take the average of the velocity inner product with this position gradient here, unintegrated over all velocity space. Well, that's not so easy anymore, because this quantity is in this three-dimensional volume over here, besides which you already see that this is a nonlinear term. You have a gradient inner product with a velocity. All right, so you're already, by changing this into an average here, you must of necessity end up with a nonlinear theory. What one can then do is see if it is possible to bring this quantity under the integral sign and then take the derivative out. All right. Now, for those of you who are interested in this, I've made a separate set of notes about this, so don't please take any notes today. What I'm going to talk about in the explanation, I will put on the web. I have it right in front of me. And for the rest of the day, I will refer to the book by Binney and Tremaine. All right, so don't worry too much about this. well, then, we see then that when taking these averages, we have already a certain number of problems cropping up that we must face Because ultimately, taking average is what we need to do in order to compare things with observations. We do not typically observe a complete census of velocity space. You may think, well, even if we were to observe only one velocity direction, namely the radial velocity direction, maybe we could arrange things in such a way that we integrate only over two velocity directions. And this indeed we can do, right? But we will talk about this later. So, we have a partial differential equation rather than a substantial differential equation. It is time dependent, it is position dependent, and it is velocity dependent. It is nonlinear because of these product terms that occur over here. And, of course, it is strongly three-dimensional, right? I mean, the vector properties of these quantities here really play a very important role. Now then, let us perhaps see if we can take a first step in the direction of finding an average, where we take the average over the equation only without putting anything else in front. Already you can sort of surmise that we will be in for trouble, even more trouble if I were to say so, when, for instance, we do not simply take an average over this equation, but take an average of the velocity. By the way, in the book, writers use very frequently an over bar in order to indicate the mean or expectation value of a quantity. I suspect that you might be more familiar with this notation, right, where you take the expectation value of a certain quantity. It means the same. It doesn't really matter. What it means, of course, is that in both of those cases, okay, you have the... I should really put this something different. We take some sort of quantity. It doesn't really matter what it is, right? You take this quantity, you multiply it with the distribution function, and you integrate over velocity space. Now, this, of course, means that we interpret the distribution function as a probability density. That can be done, provided that this equation is suitably normalized to unity, right? So that the integral of f over all velocity space and all space, all coordinate space, is unity. If then we were to look at a term like this, and we were to ask, how does it appear if we were to take a velocity average, then you were to say this, right? So the average value of the velocity, right, equals the integral over this velocity component times vi, vf, vxi. So, instantly you see that once you're interested not just simply in the distribution of the particles, the particle density, but if you're interested in the wind speed, the expectation value of the velocity, the average streaming speed of the stars at any given location, then you will deal with tensor quantities at least. All right? And this is just simply because of the vector nature of three space. We must expect then that after a lot of algebra, we will ultimately end up with a tensor equation for the averages that we get. That tensor equation, I can already say, goes basically by two names. One is the so-called Jeans equations, and the other is the so-called Virial theorem. And both of those we'll have to consider in turn. The Virial theorem, most of you might be familiar with if you have followed advanced courses in classical mechanics. The Jeans equations are a special case thereof that is mostly developed in order to treat stellar systems. Well then, let's just simply see what we can do when tackling this equation as a whole. We had already seen what remains... We had already seen what remains of the first term, because I've written that down over here, so we can replace that n is the particle density, so many particles per cubic meter. If you know the mass spectrum of the particles, then, of course, you can replace the particle density by the mass density. The mass density is typically written by with the Greek letter rho, but for the moment, I would just simply use the particle number density. Now, your next term is going to be this chap over here. And what we can do is this. We can rewrite this by asking ourselves if we can bring this V under the differential. And yes, we can do that. And you get, of course, this same integral over here, the F V sub I, VX sub I. Right, so just simply take this underneath here. And then, of course, I have to subtract what I've taken off here, like this. So it seems like a fairly straightforward trick. The point is that upon integration, we can ask ourselves what is the expectation value of the velocity gradient, sorry, the velocity divergence, I should say. What is the expectation of the velocity divergence? Because that is what this says, right? It's the ith derivative of the ith component of the velocity. Well, if we take the bounds of this integral sufficiently far out of our dynamical system, then by definition, this quantity is zero. So we can drop it, which means that the only thing that is going to remain is this thing over here. Right. Now, that also means then that this is a differential over coordinate space that I can take out of the integral because it's an integral over velocity and not an integral over space. And therefore, I can say that what I will end up with is the gradient. Okay, so I just take this thing outside the integral of f. Sorry for this, for n. And then I will write down this value over here in times the average value of the velocity in the ith direction. So this quantity here, taken out, will give me finally this quantity. It is customary in the literature not to keep this special designation for the expectation value, but we'll introduce a different variable with a very suggestive letter. All right. N is the particle density, and W is the expectation value of the streaming speed of the stars, or of any particles that obey this distribution function. The reason it's called W is intuitively obvious, because it is, in gas dynamics, it is the wind speed. It is the average speed of particles with respect to a certain fixed point. So if your fixed point over here, your cell in space, is your weather station, then what you will see here instantaneously is the wind speed at that point. Now, in order to connect with what we typically find in the literature, what I'm going to do is write this slightly differently. If we know the mass spectrum of the particles, then rather than talking about the particle density, or so many particles per cubic meter, at a given point, at your weather station over here, we talk about the mass density. And that is typically written in the following terms, zero and like this. When you think about it, what does this say? That says that at a given point in coordinate space, whatever changes inside a cell, and that change is given by this differential over here, whatever changes in this cell over here, is due to the divergence, so You see that in vector notation, this is a divergence. It's a spatial vector derivative of a vector quantity here. Is due to the divergence of the product of the mass density and the wind speed. In other words, whatever streams in and whatever streams out, I compare with one another, I take the differential, and whatever remains behind or whatever streams out contributes to the time rate of change of the total amount of mass inside that box. And therefore, the conclusion is that this is a mass conservation equation. It just simply says, so much stuff I have, so much stuff streams out, and that is why this amount changes in the following fashion. The reason I've taken so many steps here is not that it is algebraically very complex, but that you can already surmise that when you do something similar in vector space, right, when you take this in velocity space, then life can become really rather difficult. So let's be brave, and let's just simply do that, anticipating what we had said already here, that what we will expect to get is vectorial products of this sort that generate basically 3 times 3 dimensional tensors. Again, the first term, if we were to look at the expectation value of the velocity, is relatively straightforward. All we need to do is we say, we ask what is the integral over all of velocity space of this particular component of the velocity. All right. So that's not too frightfully hard. We can just simply put that since V, okay, is a substantial time derivative but not a local time derivative, we can just simply take this underneath here, and all we end up with is the partial time derivative of the expectation value of V. All right. So this effectively boils down to the time derivative of the expectation value of the velocity, which we had called W. So this effectively is all that is going to remain, which is now for the next one. Well, I already wrote that down here. The expectation value of this quantity is this expression over here. If you were to look at this with a mathematics eye, effectively what you would see is that you notice that you are in the process of asking things about the correlation between two velocities. So this term over here, tensor term, if you were to somehow translate that into ordinary human language, you would say that is how the velocity component in one coordinate direction, okay, let's say north-south, the wind speed north-south, correlates with the velocity component in another coordinate direction, that is the direction of the particles east-west. And you have 9 choices over here because you have 3 coordinate directions each. Of course, because of symmetry, some of those drop out. I mean, velocity being a symmetric object over here, we can just simply swap those. So effectively, you have only 6 independent components over here, but that is only a very small consolation. If you were to do this, you will notice that if you write out your equations, strictly speaking, you cannot really stop. You end up with an infinite sequence of correlations of velocity with correlations of velocity with correlations, etc., etc., and you have to stop them somewhere. Right? Now, where you stop depends effectively on what you believe your subgrid model is. And there again, we're coming back to something that has been a running theme in all of these considerations. Right? If you think you know what it is in the case of a thermal gas, you say, well, my collisions will average things out to such an extent that I have no local gradients, no local asymmetries, no local correlations, no local anisotropies, etc., 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 right? In particular, you will be assuming that in any given box you have no local angular momentum stowed away somewhere. then that assumption will allow you to fix this term and that term. So you will end up with only one extra equation. So the mass conservation equation is one of them. The next equation that you end up with is so-called Euler's equation. For the way in which the wind speed and the mass density of a gas change in the course of time. It is a dynamical equation. Now, in the case of stellar dynamics, your subgrid model is bound to be very much more complex. That is to say, some of the correlations that you know, either from physical intuition or from experiment or by assumption or by a certain amount of reasonableness of a thermal system, is no longer applicable in the case of a stellar system. For instance, I had already mentioned that in your subgrid model over here, you are assuming that local interactions, local collisions, will sort things out for you. That is to say, if you have a cell size here that is so small that your local gradients disappear and your local angular momentum contributions disappear, but that is so large that it's very much bigger than the mean free path for collisions between particles, then you end up with a single term over here that you can treat, and then you end up with an equation which is known as Euler's equation. In stellar dynamics, as I had abundantly demonstrated, I think, you cannot really do so. And therefore, you end up with a set of equations that are a little bit more complicated and that explicitly contain some of those non-vanishing correlations of velocities. That equation is known as the Jeans equation. All right. So the Jeans equations in stellar dynamics correspond to Euler's equations in gas dynamics. Those of you who have, in fact, taken courses in gas dynamics will now be able to link the two. I do not really want to lean on this too very much, except that because of the reasonableness, because of the way in which the particles sort things out for you, the derivation and properties of Euler's equation are really rather simpler than they are for the Jeans equations, and that is why I've taken this road in order to explain what these equations of motion are like. I'm going to take a bit of a leap and we'll do the next of those terms more or less by plausibility and then go to the actual equations for the stellar dynamics in the next step. If you were to try and evaluate this quantity over here, then what you may want to do is use the same trick that we've used in the case of the mass conservation equation, where we ended up with this divergence term over here. That is to say, you just try to put this expression here under the differentiation. All right. So let us see what that would mean in this case. You would try to write this in such a way that you have the spatial derivative in the ith coordinate direction of the following expression, of f times the ith component of the velocity times the jth component of the velocity. Well, just writing this out, you will see that only one term corresponds to this one over here. And then, of course, you have to subtract what remains, right? You have to subtract this term. I'm really fuzzy today. I'm sorry. You have to subtract this term from the left-hand side over here, right? So if you were to take this quantity and you were to replace it by a full derivative of this function over here, then you have to take this thing on the negative side. So what you will see is that you will end up with the divergence of this quantity over here minus a gradient of this quantity over here, Vi CJ. Now, in the case of an anisotropic velocity distribution, as we would have typically in the case of a stellar system, this is really rather complex. In the case of a Boltzmann gas, where your subgrid model takes care of the details, the only thing that remains of such a correlation here are the purely quadratic terms, so the V squared terms. That is more or less obvious. If you have random motions of particles, then there is no net correlation between the expectation, between the velocities in one direction and the velocities in the other direction. And therefore, the only terms that remain here are the diagonal terms, the VI, VI terms. So that is effectively a V squared. Where do we know V squared from? V squared is an energy, of course. So we get basically two terms, the divergence of flow properties, all right, so the velocity over here, the streaming, and a gradient of an energy density. Now, the microscopic energy density of a gaseous system has a name. We call it the pressure. The gas pressure is just simply so many joules per cubic meter, the energy density of a stellar system. So, looking ahead to what our equation is finally going to look like, we will see that it will be a spatial derivative of your flow quantities minus the gradient of the internal energy density, also known as the pressure. Now, mind you, this is where we part ways between gas dynamics and stellar dynamics. I'd already mentioned that in the case of gas dynamics, the correlations here just simply average out so that only the quadratic terms remain. And in a stellar system, which is effectively collisionless, this is not the case. You're getting perfectly, frankly, counter-streaming stars. I mean, after the break, I'm going to demonstrate one of those examples to you. If then we perform the corresponding algebra, we just simply take this and we integrate both terms over all of the velocity space, we are in a position to write down what remains over here. And that is, we had already, this one comes from here. The next one comes from this term over here. All right, so wj times dwi dxj. Oh, sorry for that, I did this wrong. My apologies, gee, I'm woolly. I used to write the jth component, okay? So we have the inner product of the jth component of the wind speed and the gradient in the ith coordinate direction equals minus 1 over rho. This is a normalization factor that comes in because of this f over here, times the gradient of the energy density of the particles, also known as the pressure, indicated with p typically, plus whatever remains when we integrate this thing over all the velocity space. That's fairly straightforward. You simply vdf dv crosses out, so the only thing that will remain here is the jth component of the acceleration. We see then that the streaming equation, and this is Euler's equation over here, basically contains the same three terms that we had already seen in the case of the Boltzmann equation, namely the time derivative of the wind speed, the inner product of the wind speed and its spatial derivative, which is common from the second term in the Boltzmann equation, and the external acceleration, which is this thing over here. The only extra term that we get is this thing over here, which describes the internal energy density, the energy density in our small box around our weather station over here. What is the ancestry of this term? Where does it come from? It comes from this ploy we had used over here, because in order to compute what the expectation value of this velocity is over here, We used the trick of putting everything here under the differential, and that meant that we get this extra quantity over here in return. So the nonlinearity and the velocity correlations cause this thing to pop up over here. Now, that's as may be, but what is the lesson to be learned from this? The lesson to be learned is that the overall large-scale macroscopic behavior of the velocity field of the wind speed in the case of an n-body thermal system does contain a gradient over the internal state, the gas pressure, something that you cannot directly see, at least you cannot directly see what causes it. I mean, those of you who know their history of the physical sciences will realize that this quantity over here, this pressure term over here, was a major conundrum for the first people who tried to understand what nature does, right? This pressure over here played a separate role, had to be put in by hand, had to put in from the outside, as it were. The same way as you have to pump up your bicycle tire from the outside. One of the triumphs of the Boltzmann-Gibbs theory is that this is no longer true. We do no longer have to put in this term by hand from the outside. It is a natural consequence of the fact that we deal with an n-body system. Now, this quantity over here, this pressure, in the case of a Boltzmann gas, is an isotropic quantity. It's just a scalar. That is no longer the case in a stellar system. In a stellar system, this term over here does not just simply average to the v squared diagonal. It has off-diagonal terms that do just simply not disappear, barring extremely unlikely circumstances, right? If we were to not take this step and not simplify things to this pressure, what we expect to end up with is a quantity that has tensor properties instead of scalar properties such as the pressure does. That is indeed the case, and if we take that into account, we end up with this equation over here, which is a somewhat more complex, I shouldn't say complex because that's mathematics, but somewhat more complicated version of the Euler equation over there. Now, can we already see that this is likely to cause problems? Yes. Let us consider the difference between, let us say, a self-gravitating ball of gas and a self-gravitating galaxy. If I were to take my weather station at any point in a self-gravitating ball of gas, I will find that I can still use a pressure. I can still use an isotropic distribution of velocities of the individual atoms or molecules or whatever in the gas. If, however, I will take up my weather station in a self-gravitating n-body system, such as the Plummer model that we discussed previously, we will notice that the orbits of the particles that go, shall we say, tangential to the radius vector will have a different distribution from the ones that have a radial dependence, right? There will be a non-isotropic distribution of velocities. And that means that even in such a totally simple spherically symmetric case, we need to deal with this rather than with that. To finalize and come back to my first remarks of this first lecture of today, we then can only hope that if we take suitable spatial averages over this quantity over here, we will end up with observables that are at least reasonable from the point of view of telescope astronomy, right? So we will end up with an equation that has these extra tensorial terms, and that will therefore be very much more complicated. But then what we will try to do is average over coordinate space and then say, well, perhaps we will end up with something that is reasonable and more easy to understand. That leads us then to the virial theorem, which is effectively another form of looking at averages over self-gravitation or of a self-gravitating N-body system. So what remains to be done now is to take the leap from this quantity over here. This is going to remain more or less similar. From this quantity over here, via this and that, to the Jeans equation.